not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Well now, this is a strange one. I must apologize to everybody. I don't know what happened. I have a satellite clock on the wall, and evidently it is... Well, is it or isn't it off today? I don't know. I'm a time freak. I'm looking around at computers here and see, here's an old faithful cell phone. Let's look at it and see what time it is. No, we're okay. Don't know what's happening then. I see on the computer that it says 3:04, and on the satellite clock it says 3:02:40. Of course, there's a 20-second delay on the stream, and the cell phone says it's 3:02:46 right now. So, oh, who knows? I don't know what's going on with that. But if we're late where you are, we apologize. If we're not, we don't. Let's just say it's that simple. Okay. I know now for a fact that we are on time. The cell phone and the satellite clock both clicked over at 3:03 exactly at the same time. So, my clock is right. I thought so. Anyway, welcome to the program. How did I get sidetracked on that? I don't know. A lot going on today. We should have a packed show for you. I don't know. I had to rearrange how I was going to do everything just a short time ago. We've got a great interview for you coming up at the bottom of this hour. Edward Peck is going to be on us. Edward has quite a resume. He was Special Assistant to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during a Nixon administration. He was served as Chief of the Mission in Baghdad in the Carter administration, and that was during the Carter administration. He later held senior posts in Washington and abroad, and he served as a Foreign Service Officer in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Egypt, as well as being the Ambassador in Mauritania. And he was... State Department Deputy Director of Covert Intelligence Programs and Director of Office of Egyptian Affairs, and as a Special Assistant to the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, he's done it all. He's going to be with us at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk about AIPAC. Yes, we're going to talk about AIPAC at the top of the hour. And and of course, when we're done with that, our good friend Mark Levine is going to be with us, and he and I are going to battle it out over this Israel-AIPAC thing. Mark and I agree on just about everything politically, but we don't agree on that. So Mark's going to be with us at 4 o'clock. I don't know what we'll do with the news people. We'll do something. Anyway, Mark's going to be with us at 4 o'clock, and we'll talk about that. And since we're not going to be on tomorrow, later on in the program, we're going to have a tribute to Bobby Kennedy. Tomorrow being the 40th anniversary of that tragedy, and we will do that later on in the program, maybe in the last half hour of the program. We're going to have a nice tribute to Robert F. Kennedy. Of all the Kennedys, and I have admired them all, the men, Edward and Bobby and John, probably Bobby the most. One must wonder what life in these United States might have been, how it might have been different had the assassination of Robert Kennedy had not happened. Might have been tremendously different. Who knows? Anyway, that's what we're doing for the next 2 hours, and we hope you'll be with us all during that time. We hope to keep you entertained and informed today. I hear it's going to be all over with on Saturday. All over with. Now, the people in the chat room make me feel bad. ELO writes, I was barely 6 weeks old when Bobby was murdered. Well, I was, shall we say, older than that. I remember it well. I remember that night. I was watching late night TV. That was back in the days. It wasn't quite horse and buggy days, but it was back in the days when TV stations signed off at night. Yes, for those of you who have never seen it, after the late show was on, they would sign off, and there'd be a test pattern come on and stay on all night long, and then they'd sign back on again in the morning. The station I was watching, the late movie was over, it had signed off, and next thing you know, back it came again. And then we got to... had to witness the terrible events of what happened that evening. And it was something that's remained with me these 40 years and still remains sad today. But anyway, when I looking at the political news today, nothing unusual about Hillary hanging it up on Friday and Saturday. I guess she's going to meet with staff on Friday and then suspend the campaign or end it or whatever on Saturday. She needed a little time to finish things up. I don't blame her for that. And now we can get down to business to kicking some elephant ass. And I feel we're going to do that in a big way this year. I'm feeling really good about that. The House, the Senate, and the White House. We're going to kick elephant ass all over the place. All over the place. Ronald Reagan neoconservatism is dead. And I hope we never see anything like it again. It was a tragedy for America. It's going to be a lot of years until we can completely get rid of the stain of the Reagan years and the neoconservatism, the memories of Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich and their gang. But isn't it great to know they're gone? And those that remain will be gone soon. I've been thinking a lot about this the last couple of days. I'm very, very proud to be living in this time when we're, you know, we'll elect a black man to the Oval Office, and we will. And I've mentioned before, I'm sure, sometimes I forget myself, but how our family trips, when we were a kid, we'd go visit my, I lived in Ohio, and we'd go visit my grandfather in Kissimmee, Florida, every summer. And my father would have to try and explain to me when we'd get to like Chattanooga, Tennessee, and into that area about the white-only restrooms and the drinking and fountains and how we were in fear one night in a city in Alabama, I think it was Birmingham, where martial law had been declared because of racial problems, and we were looking down the barrel of an Alabama National Guardsman rifle when we left our room to try and get something to eat. We never did get anything to eat that night. But... and I also remember talking about Blockbusters. Anybody know what I mean when I'm talking about Blockbusters? I'm not talking about video rental stores. That was a term they used about homes being sold in white neighborhoods to black folks. All of that shameful history. And last night, some of the shame of those memories were washed away. Night before last, actually. And I'm grateful for that experience. And I was thinking, if we could only see the faces today of Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, some of the black students who I remember very well when they enrolled in the University of Arkansas in Little Rock, Arkansas, so many years ago, and if only Bobby Kennedy could see this. If only all of those who were so instrumental in the civil rights movement could see this. Man, wouldn't that be a sight? There'd be a lot of tears of joy. Tears of joy. And a lot of laughter and smiles as well. And I want all of you Democrats and liberals who were against Hillary Clinton to remember something. You may not like her. You may not like her husband, Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton. And I've seen and heard over these past few months some awful attacks against her and Hillary and Bill this year. And you may feel that you've got some legitimate reason to dislike the both of them. Fine. But there are some things that I don't like about them either. However, I don't know anybody that there isn't something I don't dislike about them. But you should remember that Bill Clinton, with Hillary's help, helped bring down these neocons. They were very instrumental in all that. And had Bill not won the presidency when he did, Think about this. The neocons would have had 20 straight years of uninterrupted power in Washington, D.C. That is a... No, it had been probably 24. And you may want to think about that. Just how disastrous that might have been for this country. Even worse than it is now. But I respect the fact that both of them are fighters, and we should all respect that. And had Al Gore and John Kerry had some of that same fighting spirit, that never-say-die attitude, we probably never would have had this disastrous Junior Bush administration. So kudos to the Clintons for that. So I guess it's time to get ready. The main event started, and it's going to be an all-out war, and you will no doubt, and I'm ready for it, you're going to see and hear some jaw-dropping moments in the months to come before this election. Republicans are going to go after Barack, they're going to go after his wife, they're going to go after his kids, and the family dog, if they got one yet. I know he said if he won the nomination, he told the kids he'd get him a dog. They'll have him portrayed as Step and Fetch It, and if you're a youngster, check that out on the Google, Step and Fetch It. There'll be racism exhibited that you just won't believe. But I'm not going to be shocked about anything I see them do, because I know who they are, and I know what they're capable of, and I know it's going to be ugly, so there's not going to be any shock involved. But we're going to win this one. We have a great candidate who can raise lots of money. We've got Democrats all over America ready to roll up their sleeves and help. And we've got a lot of non-Democrats who join us as well. Be certain of that. And I'm confident, and you can probably hear it in my voice, I'm very confident that Obama's going to wipe the floor with John, you got to be kidding me, McCain. Yeah. After watching that deal of his the other night, you got to be kidding me, it certainly is the apt description of John McCain, that speech of his night before last. Ooh, man. And like you're talking about on the chat room, the media's having a field day with Barack and Michelle's fist bump. What are they saying, something negative about it? What would that be? I thought that was cute as it could be. I really did. Thought that was really cool. There's some genuine affection between those two people. You can just see it. You can easily see it. And you can tell there's a great amount of respect. That was quite a scene the other night, the smiles of those two when they took to the stage. I was very happy to see it. It was a great thing to see. 866-546-5254. As I mentioned, coming up at the bottom of the hour, former Ambassador Edward Peck's going to be with us. We're going to talk about a very controversial subject, the AIPAC, how all the media and all the Democratic and Republican politicians just flocked to the AIPAC convention in Washington, D.C. and just get down on their knees for them. So we do want to talk about that coming up. And then after that, we're going to have Mark Levine with us to talk about AIPAC and Israel and all of those type issues. Where was I here? Got a lot to talk about John McCain today. I have quite a bit to mention about John McCain. I probably shouldn't even get involved in it before we have our guest on at the bottom of the hour, but I do want to talk considerably about John McCain today and how he really is another Bush. Or Bush is another McCain. I'm not sure which is the proper way to put it, but oh my God. These guys, when you look at it, it is true that John McCain's never seen a war he didn't like. As somebody mentioned to me the other day in an email, and we'll talk about that later on today, but somebody mentioned to me in an email that if John McCain had his way, we'd probably still be fighting in Vietnam. And I'm not so sure they're wrong about that. John McCain just seems to be that's his first answer to everything. Did any of you see the story about his book? I never read his book, and I saw some excerpts from it today. And that, and we're talking about John McCain's temper. That when he was a kid and he didn't get his way, that it says this in his book, an emailer sent me quotes from his book, that he would hold his breath until he passed out. Yeah. Is that true? Can somebody do that? Do you actually have the physical discipline to hold your breath until you passed out? And if you do have that kind of discipline to do a thing like that, is that a good thing? That would make me wonder about somebody's psyche if I knew that they did that a lot when they were a kid. Ooh. I mean, I know kids do some crazy things, but to hold their breath until they passed out, I honestly didn't know that was possible. And they say that John McCain actually said that he did that and mentioned it in his book. I don't know that to be absolutely true, but I was sent that today by one of my reliable correspondents. So I have to think it's probably true. Whew. And did you know, I did want to mention this today. I didn't want the whole day to go by. I ran across a website that you just won't believe. Write this down, kids, because you got to check this up. This website, youvebeenleftbehind.com. Youvebeenleftbehind.com. And from the folks over at Wired.com, if millions of Christians suddenly disappear from the face of the earth as the opening act for Armageddon, Threat Level thinks most non-believers will be too busy freaking the hell out to check their email. But if they do log in now, they can be treated to some post-rapture needling from their missing friends and loved ones, courtesy of web startup You've Been Left Behind. Now get this. This is something you may want to get in on. For just $40 a year, yes, friends, $40 a year, believers can arrange for up to 62 people, I don't know why 62, to get a final message exactly 6 days, I'm not kidding you, exactly 6 days after the rapture, that day when, according to Christian end times dogma, Christians will be swept up to heaven while doubters are left behind to suffer 7 years of tribulation under a global government headed by the Antichrist. The website You've Been Left Behind gives you one last opportunity to reach your lost family and friends for Christ, reads the website, which is purportedly run by Christians for Christians. The domain name is registered through an anonymous proxy service, presumably to protect the proprietors from the forces of darkness, and not because they're up to anything shady. The emails will be triggered when three of the site's five Christian staffers scattered around the U.S. fail to log in for 6 days in a row. See, that's the kick. Everybody will know they're gone. That's a system that incorporates a nice margin of safety should two of the proprietors turn out to be unrepentant sinners or atheists. Wow. Users can upload up to 150 megabytes of documents, which will be protected by an unidentified encryption algorithm until the rapture. Then released to up to 12 non-believers of your choice. The site recommends that you use that storage to house sensitive financial information. Y'all paying attention here? I know you're probably logging into that site right now. In the encrypted portion of your account, you can give them access to your banking, your brokerage, your hidden valuables, and powers of attorneys, the site says. There won't be any bodies, so probate court will take 7 years to clear your assets. To your next of kin. 7 years, of course, is all the time that will be left. So basically, the government of the Antichrist gets your stuff unless you make it available in other ways. Of course, some of us would sooner trust the Antichrist with our stuff than turn it over to a company that hides behind an anonymous domain registration service and doesn't list a single corporation officer or employee by name on its website. The company You've Been Left Behind, LLC, didn't respond to an email query raising the obvious questions of whether the rapture has already begun. Oh, well. So, check that out. YouveBeenLeftBehind.com, only $40 a year, and they will contact everybody you know during and after the rapture period there to let them know that you're gone and all that, where they can... Oh, boy. Now, I'm not so interested in the people running that website. That's not a mystery to me. The ones I want to meet are the ones signing up for that. These would be, as I often like to say, these would be some of the people sitting in the front row of the professional wrestling matches, right? That's what I always say about my favorite Republicans. Those are the people that buy the front row seats to the World Wrestling Federation matches. Those are those ones you see in the first couple of rows. Those are my Republican friends. Got to be, doesn't it? I thought you'd enjoy that story about youvebeenleftbehind.com. Only $40 a year. And that's for 62 people that you can send a final message out to. I mean, what do you send out to the 60 people if the rapture's taking place? What do you send? What kind of a message do you send your friends? I'm gone and you're not. Is that it? Hey, sucker, I'm gone and you're left here with the Antichrist. Would you know? I'd be one to think up a message like that and leave. Ah, yes. Well, anyway, just a funny little story to tell you today. A fool and his money is soon parted. That's for sure, Cobweb. That's for sure. Whenever there's any money around, there's always somebody waiting to take it. You know that. I bet some of Benny Hinn's people probably signed up for that service. No doubt. We've got time for a quick call. Let's just do that. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, I didn't know I was on the air.
Yes.
Juanita.
Yes, hi, Juanita.
I guess those people that are running in that site, it sounds like they were left behind.
Well.
I mean, doesn't it?
Maybe they're making a lot of money off it there, you know?
Oh, I bet they are.
I don't know anybody that's signed up for it yet, but
I know some people who might do that.
Well, you know, the question was, what kind of a message would you leave behind?
Well, what they think is that the message, you could leave the message of the plan of salvation, and those would be here, and you can save a lot of people that way.
Oh, so if you're left behind and you're not part of the original group,
You can be listening to those things,
and you can redeem yourself. Then you can
right.
You can join them.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not a bad deal for $40.
I know. I'm worried about those people that are taking care of the
yeah
money.
Yeah, only $40. I didn't think of it that way. If you can be reminded of all your
if you see, there's one movie called Tribulation.
Haven't seen that.
That was. Well, it's sort of like Left Behind, the movie.
I didn't see that one either.
I've seen bits and pieces, but what was so funny to me was that these kids that were left behind, you know, teenagers or 20s or whatever, including Harry Mandel was in it.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, he was going to follow the Antichrist, and he repented of it. But anyway, some of the people, I think some of them, saw some of the shows, and it was that man and his wife that teach about the end times on it's Tim LaHaye, it's the other couple.
Oh yeah, I know who you mean. I can't think of his name.
And I thought, oh brother, of all things for them to pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hokey.
Well, I can't imagine Howie Mandel in that.
Yeah, Howie Mandel was in it. He was going to follow the Antichrist, you know. And
Howie Mandel. What's the name of that movie?
Heading and everything. But you know, what are they going to do about all those clothes that people are left behind?
Well, there's a lot of secondhand stores. I imagine they'll do all right for a while, but then again, they only got 7 years to sell them.
And I wonder, too, what about all those false teeth and breast implants?
Now you've really thought this through.
I have.
Yeah, false teeth, and there'd just be piles of them.
When I was into that, and I first heard about the rapture, they just said you'd be gone, and people would wonder where you were.
Yeah.
But now you got evidence of your glasses and everything.
Well, that's true. You know, your fillings in your teeth.
Contact lenses.
Yeah. Well, there'd just be a little pile of junk laying there on the floor. That's a little pile of clothes and junk.
To me, I think it's making fun of God. I don't think that's my opinion.
Yeah,
I don't like it.
Well, they're making a buck, and that's what it's at. That's what it's all about. $40 a year. You know, everybody can have your ashes shot up into space now. That's pretty expensive. And you can join this thing for $40 a year. So I guess you can get yourself covered all over the place really well. Hey, we need a thanks for calling. Good to hear.
Okay,
interesting conversation today. Bye-bye. I never thought about that. The false teeth and the implants and contact lenses. That's funny, Juanita. That really is funny. Hey, we're going to pause for a quick break. We've got our guest coming up here in just a moment or two. So don't go any place. We'll be back in, not long at all. Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. Thanks so much for listening. As promised right now, I have Edward Peck on the line. Ed has got a resume a mile long. We'll probably talk about that a little bit. And suffice to say, if anybody would know about the subject I wanted to talk about today, I don't know who'd be better to talk about it than him. Ed, welcome to the show.
A pleasure so far, sir.
So far. Well, we'll try and keep it that way. I know you're a former ambassador to, Mauritania?
Mauritania and a place called Iraq.
Where else?
Iraq.
Oh, well, yes. You were in Iraq during the Carter administration, right?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
You've been just all over the Mideast, right?
Well, yes. The U.S. government trained me to be able to live with and work among and talk to people in the Middle East and North Africa. So that's where I spent most of my diplomatic career.
Wow. And you were there for quite some time.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I hope this comes across, I describe myself as a Middle East expert because, unlike most of our compatriots, I know where it is.
Do you, when you're over there a lot like you were, do you have to learn a lot of the languages, or are you provided a interpreter all the time? Or?
Oh, no, it's interesting how these things work out. When I joined the Foreign Service from California, I didn't speak any languages. I'd studied them in school, you know, but they never taught us to talk. So I learned, they gave me full-time French language training here, and then I took morning Spanish here. And then I went to Sweden, of course, where I was able to learn Swedish. And so when I came back from that, they said, you have some language skills. And I blushed modestly. And they said, well, would you like to learn a hard language? And I said, why not? And so they showed me a list of the hard languages that they were teaching. And you take Finnish and you go to Finland, and you take Hebrew and you go to Israel, and you take, you know, Chinese, you go to China. So I looked at Arabic, where you got, you know, 16 different countries. So that's what I signed up for. Not for any other reason, really, but I went into the Foreign Service because I wanted to travel. So I've worked from one end of the Arab world, Mauritania, pretty much to the other, Iraq, and several places in between.
Did you by any chance know a gentleman by the name of Paul Gibson?
Paul Giffen?
Paul Gibson.
Gibson. I don't think so.
Okay.
Was he in that part of the world?
Well, he was quite a little bit. He had an office over in K Street. He was a friend of mine that passed away just a little long, not too very long ago.
I don't think so, sir.
Okay. What I wanted to talk about today, and you and I briefly discussed it, I want to talk about AIPAC. They've certainly been in the news lately. Once again, they are every year about this time.
Yes, sir.
And it seems to me that they have an inordinate amount of influence in this country, and that's beginning to bother me a little bit. How and why has this happened?
Well, I hate to sound as if I'm pontificating, but a nation like ours works on the basis of citizens expressing to the government what they would like to see or not see, and they can sometimes band together in groups that are called lobbies. And some of them for good and some of them are for ill, but lobbies are an integral and important part of our system of government. In the case of AIPAC, it has become incredibly powerful. I think you can see that just from the list of people who appear at their conventions to plead for support. Every political candidate, the leaders of the House and Senate, the Secretary of State, everybody goes there. Because it is an extremely powerful, well-financed group. There is nothing inherently wrong with that. I personally feel, and this is a view that's shared by a lot of folk, apparently your one, is that perhaps it has too much power over important aspects of our national policies, especially in the field of foreign affairs. And not only that, and this is the part that worries people like me and perhaps you, is that they've succeeded essentially in silencing anybody who doesn't agree with them. And that's the part of it that I'm worried about, because a free, open debate in this society on a whole range of issues supposedly, or in theory at least, permits the American public to decide what they want to see and what they don't want to see.
Well, certainly, and since Barack Obama's speech the other night, I'd say there are two things they've heard the most about. Number one, about Hillary, is she going to take the vice presidency or not? And number two, AIPAC, about how Hillary and Barack and everybody else in Washington worth their salt has ended up at the AIPAC conference bowing and making sure that they've got their campaign contributions solidified.
Well, not only the campaign contributions, but avoiding the incredible pressure that can be brought from the other side if the lobby or its leaders decide that this is not the person they want. It's been very worrisome, because nobody in their right mind And you and I would agree that an awful lot of people don't qualify for that description.
I'm afraid so.
But nobody in their right mind should want anything bad to happen to a single Israeli, or, take it one step farther logically, to a single American. But the simple fact of the matter is that bad things have happened to both groups, are happening to both groups, and will probably happen to both groups, and I hope I'm wrong, because of what's going on in Palestine. And I haven't even mentioned those people who are having a rough time of it as well. But you can't discuss these things here, which is the part of Lapi's activities which distress me. In Israel, they have enormous flaring debates and arguments and discussions in the Knesset about whether they should be doing this or that in the occupied territories and how it should be. It's all wide open, but it isn't here. So if you look down the web at what Haaretz has to say or the other newspapers in Israel that are on the web, you know, and you see all the sorts of things that they're talking about, which we don't talk about. And that's what distresses me.
Why do you think that is? Why is that happening?
Well, it's because they have essentially, there's been a great deal of control developed over the actions of the media. There's been a great deal of control developed over the actions of the Congress and the White House, showing up in the AIPAC meetings that they attend and all of that. Plus the fact that nobody wants to be accused of being an anti-Semite, which is the weapon that they use on anybody who criticizes Israel. I have been in some interesting debates with my Israeli friends here in Washington and overseas, and I say, boy, if criticizing the government is anti-Semitic, you've got a bunch of newspapers over there that qualify.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
We don't have any here.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So, because the folks in our country, the Americans here, don't want those things to come up. For all sorts of reasons, both valid and invalid, and they've been very successful in eliminating, really, the debate or stifling it. I offer you, for example, this fellow Jimmy Carter, a decent man, I think anybody would agree, and quite recently he went over to Israel to talk to Hamas and others, if you recall, and the American government and the Israeli government not only stiffed him, but they insulted and denigrated him. And my concern is that what he was going over there for was to do things which would be good for Israel.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that was his objective, to make life better and all that. And so they beat up on him. I have to bring this up, too, because it's a point to bear in mind. The Israeli government talks about their separation wall that's being built there. And that's what they call it, a separation wall, although, as you probably know, there's a third of a million Israelis on the eastern side of it and three-quarters of a million Palestinians on the western side of it. So it really isn't. But they call it a separation wall.
Actually, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. It looks more like a prison wall with a guard tower.
Well, it is a prison wall in a way. The Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank are in the world's largest fresh air prisons. But the reason I bring this up is I have done this when I was in Jerusalem last year, just about this time. I asked an Israeli official I was talking with. He was talking to the group I was with, and he mentioned the separation wall, and I raised my hand, and he said, yes, a question. I said, yes, do you know how to say separation in Afrikaans?
Mm-hmm.
And the word is?
Apartheid.
Apartheid.
Yes.
I mean, that's what apartheid means. It means separation. So Carter put that word in the title of his book, you know, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Yes.
And was just, you know, savaged and attacked and insulted and denigrated for daring to use that word.
Certainly.
But so that the problem here is that, you know, I was on another network not too long ago, and they said that they had just the day before played the one-hour interview I'd had with their key anchor person. This was NPR,
mm-hmm.
6 or so years ago. And they said every single thing that you said was going to happen if we invaded Iraq has happened. Doesn't that make you proud? And I said, absolutely not. I would much rather have been wrong.
Well, back when you said it, it made you crazy, or
yeah, that's right. And you get denigrated and
unpatriotic, seditionist, all that sort of thing. Yes,
and the rest of it. So, you know, Helmut, I'm used to that. When you lived and worked over there, and you try to develop a balanced opinion of how America could best advance its interests, how Israel might best advance its interests, you have to put on the other side of the equation, how do the other countries perceive what you're doing in terms of how they advance their interests? And this is what depresses me the most. You see, here's America, a nation built on and successful at, competitive private enterprise. So one of the things we should have learned is that if you want to sell a product, you have to pay a little bit of attention to what it is the customer wants, and perhaps even more important, how it is the customer sees it, the perception of the product.
Yes.
Because if they don't like it or don't perceive it as being, they ain't going to buy it. And so over there, where we tend to ignore almost totally how it is the people over there feel about various things, it should not be a surprise that we're not having a very successful sales campaign.
Certainly not.
No, not at all.
The Israeli people, how do they feel about the Palestinian situation if you had to...
Well, it depends, of course, on exactly who you ask. Just like here, guy, you know what I'm talking
sure.
about. The polls that they conduct in Israel show that a majority of the people want to find some peaceful way of resolving the issue with the Palestinians. A sizable majority. But in the same sense that a sizable majority of Americans want to find some way to get out of the Iraqi war, the government doesn't, or the administration doesn't. And so you wind up being led in America by governments which must be described as hawkish. That's not a dirty word. Hawkish governments, and in Israel, the same way. So the Israelis want very much, their hope, their dream is to live in peace and security among their neighbors. I mean, and that's an objective that everybody could support and commend, but they're not going at it the right way.
No.
Therein lies the problem, because you don't get, what is it that Ronald Reagan said, not famous as a philosopher, but he had one wonderful phrase which I have always admired. He said, peace is not the absence of conflict. It is the handling of conflicts in a peaceful manner.
Yes.
Yeah, out of the way, Ron.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that, my guy. and we're not interested in that. We're up to our clavicles in Iraq with no reasonable way to get out of that one. We are now making noises, and Mr. Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, said that when he came here, he was going to discuss with President Bush, I think they met yesterday, the absolute necessity of attacking Iran.
Yes.
Well, it is difficult for me to imagine a more blindly stupid and horrifying act than that, regardless of whether Israel does it or we do it, because if they do it, we're in it, and we will bring down upon our heads, I'm afraid, of long-term suffering for an awful lot of people, including us.
And yet it is something that is very realistic, isn't it? It could happen.
Yeah, it's realistic here. You see, one of the problems, let me just mention in passing that twice in time of war I served my nation in uniform, serving with the paratroops. And I've been out on the front lines as a diplomat through wars and coups and riots and life-threatening diseases and evacuations and all of that. And I don't take a backseat to anybody in terms of patriotism, because this is the greatest nation that has ever been. It could conceivably be the greatest nation that ever will be. But that is not a universally shared perspective. An awful lot of people don't see us in that light anymore, because we've lost our moral standing. Here is a nation, ours, which both in the media and governmentally has blasted and, insulted the government of Myanmar for refusing to let relief supplies come in for people who are suffering from the effects of a natural disaster. But in Gaza, the people are suffering from the effects of a political disaster because they can't get food or medicine or gas. And we support and arm and finance the government that's doing that. So this I have come to call, you may use the phrase with full attribution, this is called dynamic hypocrisy. Not just sitting quietly and being hypocritical, because let's face it, there are times when we all are. If my kids did it, it's okay, guy, but if your kids did it, we're going to call the cops, right?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So everybody does that, but we do it. You know, we step right up and say, look at us, we're going to excuse that and damn that. And how do you explain it? Well, that's different.
And we have a long history of that with the Israelis.
Well, yes, sir, we do. And, you know, in many cases, the Israelis are right.
Yes.
Part of the problem here is because of this rather worrisome control of the media, you don't read about what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank the way you might if the shoe was on the other foot. Which, you know, distorts the understanding. And Americans have so many cliche statements that are not factual about the situation out there that it's a little scary, a little worrisome, because nobody's able to stand up and say, oh, excuse me, but that's not correct.
Well, and I lay a lot of the blame for that right at the feet of the media.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
They've been
the media is a business operation. And if they get told to, not to print any more of those kinds of stories, or they're going to lose advertising or subscriptions or revenue, they have to listen, because it's a business activity. And it's that part of it, as I say again, that really concerns me, because I am not certain what the American public would do if they really knew what's going on. I'll merely offer you one example. On two occasions, I have co-led delegations to the State Department in recent years to protest the fact that the U.S. government has never said one word about the arrest and imprisonment of American citizens in Israel or the Palestinian territories.
Mm-hmm.
And you may remember that 2.5 years ago there was this great, horrendous thing when China arrested a green card holder.
Oh, yes.
We're going back. I mean, my God, the White House, the State Department, they're bellowing, and she was not an American citizen. But for decades now in Israel, American citizens, some of them of Palestinian origin, but some of them native-born, have been arrested and imprisoned. They have alleged torture in some cases. They've had their passports taken away from them, which is against the rules. And you've never seen a word. Not one. Now, would it make any difference if it were known? I don't know. But I can recall very clearly when America changed its views about the war down there in Central America, when the 6 American nuns were killed.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And all of a sudden, my God, they're killing Americans?
Yes.
Well, so this news just does not get out there. And the State Department, I've gone in to talk to these folks, and we're talking at the working level, not the people who make the decisions, so you can't beat up on them. You know, it's like blaming the guy at the airport if your suitcase doesn't make it.
Yeah.
So we don't do that, but we say, how can they? That's the policy. We don't talk about it.
Hmm. Well, there's a lot that doesn't get talked about when it comes to Israel, and like I said, I don't want to make this sound like I always condemn Israel. I don't over everything. There's some things they're absolutely right on, some things they're absolutely wrong on, but it's the problem of the wrong. And it's like I'm going to discuss with a friend of mine coming up at 4 o'clock. You know, the spying, for example, is something that sends me crazy. The Pollard situation and these guys from AIPAC, who is it, Rosen and Franklin, that have been indicted. I don't know where that stands right now, but that just sends me up the wall when I know we're sending a lot of aid their way. We've loaned them a lot of money, given them a lot of benefits.
It's not loans, it's gifts.
Well, it ends up, yeah. And
they are. It is not a loan.
Well,
$126 billion.
Yeah.
Yeah, something along those.
And that's
so
how we
the
get
economic that's, side. That's not the military.
That's how we get repaid.
No, it's not. And the thing is, of course, that Israel is a wealthy country.
Yes.
Israel receives over one half of our global budget for economic assistance. And they're one of the, you know, they're one of the wealthier countries in the world, and the high GNP and all the rest of it. They need it the least. So when Mr. Obama promises, you know, $10 billion in the next, no, $30 billion in the next 10 years, he's merely putting a 10-year figure on what we give every year anyway.
Sure. Well, one last question I want to know. We were talking about hawkish governments, and that's not always bad. Old Mayor, as you know, has got some political problems at home that that may cause him to have to vacate the office. He's promised he would if he gets indicted. If Netanyahu gets back in there, are we going to have more of a problem with the hawkishness?
Well, we'll certainly have a similar level of problems with the hawkishness. Mr. Netanyahu has never ever been accused of being a dove.
No.
So that's. I was on a panel discussion here the other day, and I used the phrase "occupied territories." And one of the gentlemen, and I use that word correctly, a gentleman on the panel with me represents the Zionist Organization of America, and he said, "Hold it, not an occupied territory. That's a disputed territory." And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm really quoting Prime Minister Sharon." So you take it up with him.
Yeah.
He calls it an occupied territory. But here we talk about a disputed territory, which is a phrase that nobody uses except, you know, the people who tend to be of that hawkish persuasion. Because there's a price attached to doing what they are doing, not only for them, but for us, because we make it possible. Nobody blames America for what's happening in Darfur. And nobody blames America for what's happening in Myanmar. But they do blame us for what's happening in Palestine and Gaza. Do we have just one other moment?
Yes, oh yes.
Just to tie this, we have in the United States groups of women who are in concerned about and offended by and working to help the situation of women in other countries with whom they don't have any linkage whatsoever except the chromosome. I mean, they're different linguistically, ethnically, religiously, racially. They're different, but they're women, and so American women are concerned. It shouldn't, therefore, surprise anybody that the 1.5 billion Muslims in this world don't like what's happening to Muslims in the Middle East. And people in the Middle East and North Africa who are ethnically and linguistically tied to the people in Palestine don't like what's happening to them. And some of them don't like it very strongly.
Yes.
Which is also understandable.
It is.
You don't have to agree with them. But if you refuse to accept the possibility that their perceptions are different, or worse, if you decide that their perceptions don't matter, you're merely making it that much harder to accomplish whatever it is you're attempting to accomplish. And that's what we're doing over there, is step across the border, you know, into Iran, and consider that by definition, you cannot compel people to be democratic. That's
no.
A contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron.
That's the old...
You're going to be democratic. Yes, yes, don't shoot.
The old, you can put water in front of a horse, but you can make him drink. And
something along those lines.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's what you can't do. And if you remember that when our government was formed, we the people and all of that, we had slavery for the first 67 years, and we waited 130 years to give the women a vote.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, Iraq, you got a weekend. Write a constitution. It took us, what, 9 years to write ours?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, it scares me because Americans are convinced that everybody in the world just wants to be exactly like us, and that's not true. Some of them have no interest in it whatsoever, and others are definitely opposed to the concept. It doesn't make them right.
But we were raised that way, weren't we?
Well, we've come to believe it because the nation is rich and successful.
Yeah.
And I'll stand up someplace and a person will jump. This actually happened. A lady jumped up in the audience and she said, I hate Muslims. And I said, madam, will you tell us why? She said, yes. All Muslims know is terrorists, killing, murder, bloodshed. And I said, so that's what's been going on in Northern Ireland. I never dreamed. I said, madam, I now understand World War II and the Holocaust.
Yes, good.
And she came right back, and she said, Muslims kill other Muslims. And I said, the Civil War? My God, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And I said, you are suffering from terminal bigotry.
Absolutely.
Atheists know how to kill, so do Hindus. So do Christians, so do Jews, so do Muslims. even agnostics.
We're all guilty.
Yeah. Well, I feel much better, Doctor. Go ahead.
Yes. Ed, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. I really appreciate hearing your insight in all this. I want to reserve the right to have you back on again some of these days.
I'm honored, and I certainly hope that everybody remembers what I started out at the beginning. No one should want anything bad to happen to one single Israeli.
That's right.
But the path they're on now, I fear, is going to lead to trouble for a long time to come.
It may well.
Yes, sir.
Ed Peck, thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure, sir.
Bye now.
Bye.
Interesting gentleman. Sorry about the little hum there in the background. We didn't have a good audio connection, and we had to turn the volume up here in the studio and get that old built-in hum there. We'll try and chase that down and see what's up with that. We're gonna go to some news real quick like right now, and right after that we're gonna have Mark Levine on. So don't go away. We'll be back right after this quickie news here.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The announcement that came on Tuesday that General Motors would be closing more plants has had ripple effects throughout communities. In Toronto on Wednesday, more than 100 workers blocked the road, leading to GM's Canadian headquarters. They did so to protest the announced closing of a plant in Oshawa, Ontario, which employs 2,600 workers. Canadian Auto Workers President Buzz Hargrove said the workers see the plant closing as a betrayal of the labor agreement the automaker reached with the union in May. The union says that under the deal, the Oshawa plant must remain open until 2011. In response to the protest, GM shut down the headquarters for the day, letting staff go home early. Hargrove asked the workers to end the blockade as he heads to Detroit for a meeting with GM Chief Executive Rick Wagoner. The company plans to shift production to Mexico. In all, the company announced plans to close 4 plants in North America.
Laborers President Terry O'Sullivan says the U.S. will fall behind economically unless we rebuild our roads, bridges, airports, and railroads. The Laborers' Petition to Rebuild America campaign aims to get at least 1 million signatures supporting the huge investment needed to rebuild America's infrastructure. O'Sullivan says current methods of financing roads, railroads, bridges, and airport construction are inadequate. He says we have to change our model of financing these projects to pay for what he says are at least $1.6 trillion in needed repairs. The Laborers Union says doing this work will generate many good-paying jobs while also making an investment in America's future. To do this politically, O'Sullivan says a bipartisan movement must rally behind it. The Laborers' Campaign to Rebuild America includes a print and broadcast media advertising effort in Washington, D.C., Denver, and other cities.
Investor Carl Icahn is blaming employee severance for the failure of Microsoft's takeover bid of Yahoo. He demanded that Yahoo's board of directors throw out the employee severance plan, or that he would go to shareholders and ask them to fire the entire board. In case of a buyout, Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang wanted to make sure the 13,800 employees that helped build his company were protected in the event of being laid off or reassigned. Here is today's economic report. Who is being hit the hardest by the housing slump? A new study suggests it is Hispanic workers, who lost 250,000 jobs last year in the construction trade. The study, released on Wednesday by the Pew Hispanic Center, found that the unemployment rate of Hispanics rose to 6.5% in the first quarter of 2008. The average rate for non-Hispanics is 4.7%. Immigrant Hispanics are being hit even worse. Unemployment for that community rose to 7.5%.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Hope you enjoyed that interview. Always good to talk to someone as experienced as Ed Peck. My goodness, the man definitely has been around the block or two and knows what he's talking about. And I got a guy with me right now that's been around the block a time or two and definitely knows what he's talking about in the world of Washington, D.C., and politics and many other things besides that. One of the very nicest people I've met in Washington, D.C., and, of course, fellow member of the Horn, Mark Levine. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Guy. I appreciate all the compliments. I hope we still have that compliments when we're done today.
You know, I got to explain. Maybe we have to explain. Mark's been wanting to set me straight for a long time now, and on Israel, and he knows how I feel about some of the things that go on in Israel, and I know pretty much how he feels, and so he's been wanting to get at me for a long time. So I've been suckered into this. And,
No. You invited me. You've hardly been suckered into
this. This sounds like the Obama McCain town hall meetings. How they just threw out the fishing line there, and trying to reel one in there. What do you think? Will they do that? The town hall?
Oh, I'm sure they'll do a few of them. I don't know if they'll do 10, but let's get right to the issue.
All right. AIPAC, did you go to the meeting this week?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I considered going, and I decided against it.
You've been there before.
I have been to AIPAC meetings before, it's true.
All right.
I went about a couple years ago, was probably the last time.
But well, those people are crazy. What were you doing there?
Well, they're not crazy. They simply support a strong American-Israeli alliance.
All right, Mark, let's get to it. I've got some questions for you, and you probably got some for me.
I do, and I got a lot of things I want to say about what the ambassador said, but if I don't have time on your show, I may...
You've got time. We've got 35 minutes.
That won't be enough.
I'm going to do a tribute to Robert, and if we don't do it today, we'll do it again. What's the benefit to the United States of America for to be an ally of Israel in the fashion that we are, with the billions of dollars of aid that we give them militarily and Big Brother looking over your shoulder, protecting you no matter what you do attitude?
I think that the United States has a role in supporting democracies that are under attack all around the world. There were those that argued in World War II, what do we give a care about Britain for? Why should we waste American lives and send them to die? What do we care about England? England, hey, they attacked us. They King George III and all. So what if the Nazis take England? So what if the Nazis take France? What do we care about them?
What if somebody takes Israel? So what?
Well, you know, there are those that believe that it doesn't matter if dictatorships go and kill innocent people. There are those that felt that we shouldn't try to stop genocide and the Holocaust. I think those are the minority. I think most Americans believe that World War II was a war worth fighting, and they understand, in fact, why we support NATO. We support NATO, by the way, 100 times the money we give to Israel. For $3 billion a year we give to Israel, we spend $300 billion on NATO, and we spend $3 trillion on Iraq.
There's a benefit for NATO. What's the benefit for Israel?
What's the benefit of helping England and France when they're not even under attack anymore? Who are we helping protect England from? Who is sending missiles to destroy England? Who is sending missiles to... I mean, under the Soviet Union, yes, there was a threat to Western Europe. Today, what is the threat to Germany?
Well, if we had allowed them to go ahead and take all of Europe, then they would have been a more formidable foe than they already would have, and they would have resources, and they would have been able to come to our shores then. And don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that Israel needs to be wiped off the map or anything. I'm certainly not. I'm not anti-Semitic and not any of that. But I'm just saying, if Israel weren't even there, it would be of no consequence to America.
I disagree. I think that... helping Britain in World War II was not just about preventing the Nazis from becoming more powerful. It was about recognizing that when there are embattled allies, people around the globe who share our goals of democracy, who share our human values, who are out there trying to, you know, promote democracy, these are people we want to support. And it's true whether it's helping people in Kosovo or helping people in Darfur or helping, yes, England, France, and Germany and Japan, who are extremely rich and probably don't need our help. We have always tried to help democracies. Now, we've also helped dictatorships. Don't get me wrong. The United States has a sorry history of helping a number of dictatorships in South America and Central America and in the Middle East and all those things. There, I think we don't need to help so many dictatorships. I'd be the first to argue that that doesn't help us as much. But helping an embattled democracy that from the very day it existed, nations have been trying to wipe it off the map. In fact, it's probably the only country on Earth today that faces an existential threat to its existence. I don't know of any other nation on Earth where another nation has called for its annihilation.
Now, you don't believe that Israel is seriously threatened by anybody militarily?
I certainly do.
Well, and they've got more. They're probably what, the third most powerful military in the world, perhaps.
Israel is the size of New Jersey.
I know the size of it, but they're rich and they're armed to the teeth.
The Arab world is the size of two or three United States.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is the size of New Jersey. One nuclear bomb in the center of Israel, and you have committed the second Holocaust. It's that easy to do, even though Israel has nuclear weapons and could try to respond. And, of course, it would be hard to do so because, after all, we get 30 minutes if the Russia is to attack us, and that's missiles coming thousands of miles away. These missiles are very close. I'm not so sure Israel could respond to a nuclear attack. I'm sure they'd try. But one bomb, and boom, that's it. A second Holocaust has occurred. You know, another third of the Jewish people are dead, and there's only a third left. It's that easy. And I think to dismiss the claims of a very dangerous, aggressive dictator as a madman when he says Israel is going to cease to exist. You know, frankly, Hitler in Mein Kampf said things that were a lot calmer than Ahmadinejad has said.
Hitler had power over the military. Ahmadinejad does not.
Well, you have to imagine that whatever Ahmadinejad is saying has the support of the real leader of Iran, which is Khamenei, the Ayatollah, who runs the place. Now, I'll be the first to say that most Iranians are not anti-Israel. In fact, I would argue that Persians tend to be more pro-Israel than Arabs. And I know a number of Persians. Most Iranians, in fact, are far more pro-American than Arabs. But they're under the control of a brutal dictator that they would like to get rid of. And I myself would like to see them get rid of. Now, I don't support a war against Iran. But if they overthrow their dictatorship, I'll be the first one to cheer.
Why does Israel have, if you don't think it's it behooves them to, that they wouldn't be able to strike back and all that, why have they got a tremendous nuclear arsenal?
I think they have it.
That they won't admit.
Well, they don't admit it or deny it, actually. It's very interesting. Israel, they're actually more honest about it than American officials in the sense that George Bush will simply lie to us. Israel, when they don't want to lie, will simply not comment. Everyone knows Israel has its nuclear arsenal. And I think it's because it's under an existential threat. You know, when you look at the other countries on Earth that have nuclear weapons, you look at the democracies, United States, England, France, South Africa is now a democracy, India. Really the only one that faces a threat would be India with its threat from Pakistan or China. And that threat I don't even think is existential. I don't think, as much as Pakistan and India fight over Kashmir, I really don't think there are many Pakistanis that really think about destroying and murdering all the people of India. I just don't think they think it's possible or even want to do it. Israel is the only country with nuclear weapons that faces that existential threat. And Israel has said very clearly that they will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons in the Middle East. But they've also, I think, the subtext of that is they would be the second. In other words, it's too provide for their defense. They will never introduce it, but if they're attacked, it's to encourage people not to attack Israel.
Well, if you believe that we, the benevolent United States, is just helping poor little Israel out because we want to defend democracy around the world and help democratize countries, then you must also buy into the Bush administration's policy that we want to start and grow democracy in Iraq.
Well, I don't think it's working. I don't think you have a democratic country, a long-term standing democracy with an independent press, an independent military, an independent courts, and any of those things that Israel has. I mean, you look at Israel, they have a corrupt prime minister, and Olmert probably is corrupt. They're going to get rid of him. They're going to indict him. They're going to force him from office, just as we did Richard Nixon. That's how a democracy works. Whereas if you have a corrupt official in Iraq, I don't think they have the long-standing democratic institutions to get rid of the guy. Look, if you know, there's also a huge difference between giving aid to a country that's trying to defend itself and occupying it with 160,000 American troops. Whether you look at sheer expense, I mean, the cost of Iraq is going to be $3 trillion. The cost of Israel is $3 billion. We're spending 1,000 times our resources on Iraq as we are on Israel. So I think there is a limit, obviously.
Why are we spending anything in Israel at all? They don't need our money.
Well, you know, most members of Congress seem to feel that it should be. Most Americans feel that it should. You know, I would argue, frankly, that Israel needs our money certainly more than Germany does, more than England does. Why do we spend $300 billion on defending Japan? Japan's a very rich country. So is Germany. So is England. So is France. Why do we spend so much money defending those countries?
Well, we don't spend $500 a head, which is what it figures out to be in Israel.
I actually think we spend more. If you look at NATO and you look at the cost of NATO, now, you know, I don't know, I have to divide by the populations and figure out what it is. But I also think that Japan is not really under a significant threat. And actually, Japan is under more of a threat today than France or England or Germany. You know, Taiwan, all right, there's a country that is under a threat. I think China would like to wipe out Taiwan. There's an example for you, or maybe South Korea. But, you know, Japan is doing just fine. So I just think these should be done and you know, looked at in other contexts. We give $2 billion to Egypt, two-thirds what we give to Israel, and Egypt has a brutal dictatorship that mistreats its people, and, you know, I think we need to reconsider that aid to Egypt.
Well, they're also a very poor country.
They are, but the money's not going to the poor people because it's dictatorship. See, that's when you have a dictatorship and you give money to the dictator, it just goes to the dictator. It doesn't help your Egyptian poverty one iota.
So you really do believe that this is just in the interest of democracy, that our benevolent government leaders are just saying, you know, we love you because you're, and that's the reason we're giving you this money, just because you're...
It's more than that.
What else is it?
That Americans recognize that by far our strongest ally, our only steadfast ally, the only country that we can count on in the Middle East is Israel. You know, Saudi Arabia, that alliance is one where sometimes they'll do what we want, oftentimes they won't. Kuwait, despite the fact that we spent I don't know how many billions of dollars freeing them from their occupation, doesn't seem to be that grateful. I don't know how many, you know, we have some bases there. We don't have that kind of alliance. Really, the only alliance I think that you can compare to the American-Israeli alliance would be our alliance with our European allies, with Canada, Australia, you know, Japan, things like that. In the Middle East, which is an area that, for good or for ill, we're going to care about for times to come, it's nice to have one place where we can have military if we need to. Listen, I don't support military bases in Iraq, and I understand that we get in trouble when we have them in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. You know, that's the thing that makes Arabs very angry at us. In Israel, we have a steadfast military alliance. Israel shares with us data from terrorists that are going to attack. Israel did a very fine thing, I think, in 1982 in destroying Iraq's nuclear plant, and a very fine thing in 2007 in destroying Syria's nuclear plant. So they serve our interests, and they protect, frankly, Americans as well.
So you think that they can protect our military interest in Iraq, or in the Middle East?
Well, not in Iraq. I think Iraq is, we've made such a mess of it.
I mean, I'm looking back at Gulf War One.
Right.
The Israelis had to keep all their armaments on the planes on the ground and all that. They couldn't even join in that fight.
Well, that was George Herbert Walker Bush's decision, and it's one that, frankly, I disagree with.
Well, I think it was smarter. It would have inflamed the entire... Israel probably... they would have suffered a lot if they'd have gotten in on that.
Suffer. I mean, you know, the Gulf War is a perfect example. Here you have Iraq attack Kuwait to get Kuwaiti oil. We defend Kuwait. And what does Saddam Hussein do? He sends missiles off to attack Israel, a country that's not even involved in the fight. And that's been the problem with Israel all along. They didn't do anything in the Gulf War. They weren't even allowed to defend themselves, which, by the way, is a classic international law. Under the United Nations Charter, every nation has the right to defend themselves. And they were attacked, and their citizens were hit with missiles, and, you know, and they were supposed to just sort of stand firm and take it and go quietly to their deaths. And Israel did, because it supported its alliance with America more than it cared about protecting its own citizens, which is really an amazing thing. There's a perfect example. Israel was the victim of the Gulf War, and they weren't even allowed to fight back.
Well, let's move on to something else. I don't think they really are strategic of value to us, and you do. We'll disagree on that. What kind of allies spy on their friends?
All of them.
All of them?
We spy on Europe. Europe spies on us. France has been caught trying to get our technology secrets. Japanese spies have been caught trying to get our technology. We, by the way, have spied on Europe. We were just caught spying on Airbus company. I wouldn't be surprised if we also spy on Canada, and Canada spies on us, our closest allies.
Military secrets?
Well, they don't tend with our allies. They don't tend to be military secrets. They tend to be technology secrets. When you think about it, France spying on us to get the best technology is kind of more slimy. I mean, France isn't under attack. They're not trying to save lives. They're just trying to get better, secrets for their companies. That to me is actually more sleazy than what Israel was trying to do. I mean, Jonathan Pollard, and I don't defend what he did, but the thing he turned over to Israel did allow Israel to destroy Iraq's nuclear weapons. So, in hindsight, Jonathan Pollard, I think, at least in that score, if it's true, and I haven't seen the materials, and I don't know what else he gave, but that particular thing, I think, was good for both Israel's security and U.S. security. I mean, Ronald Reagan was dead wrong, I think, not to allow that information to get to Israel.
Well,
it doesn't justify spying, I mean, but it happens all the time.
Well, I don't appreciate it from our ally. And Jonathan Pollard incident, for example, and it's been said by people in the upper echelons of our own government, put many Americans at risk. And, that was...
And it may be true. What I find interesting about that case is that they've never allowed any reporter to find out what the information was. And if he put Americans at risk, then absolutely he deserves everything he got.
And but, how about Franklin and Rosen, the AIPAC guys?
That's a different question, because they did, in effect, what Bob Novak did or Matt Cooper of Time Magazine did. What they did is neither of them have top secret clearances. What they did is administration official that had a top secret clearance gave them information unlawfully, and that Bush official is now in jail. Then they pass that information on to other people, to Israel and to other people. In other words, just like Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby told Bob Novak about Valerie Plame, and their action is a crime, and Cheney and Libby should be in jail. It wasn't Bob Novak, as much as I detest Bob Novak, it wasn't his fault for passing it on. And the reason for that is clear, and that's why I think these people will be found innocent. The law says that you cannot, if you have access to top secret material, you cannot disclose it to a person who doesn't have access. But the person who doesn't have access, who learns it, can say whatever they want. That's why Daniel Ellsberg could talk about the Pentagon Papers, right? That was secret. Mm-hmm. The person who told him could get in trouble, but he could tell whoever he wanted. And that's why I'm very certain that those two will be found innocent. Whether you agree with what they did or not, I don't think it's a crime. I think that once an official breaks that top secret clearance, it's the official's crime and not the person who receives it.
You don't think our alliance with Israel, such as it is, has gotten us into tremendous trouble, into Iraq, for example, with the likes of Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith in the White House? You don't think that, and right now with Omer trying to push us into Iran, you don't think that's cost thousands of American lives?
I think the Iraq debacle was awful and a terrible and huge mistake. I don't think it was done for Israel. It may have been that Wolfowitz or Feith thought they were doing it for Israel. But at the end of the day, it was Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld that made the call. And I don't think they were doing it for Israel. I can't know what's in a man's heart, but I think they were doing it for oil. I think they were doing it because they thought they'd get cheap oil, the kind of oil without impurities that Iraq has that Saudi Arabia doesn't have. I don't think they did it for Israel. Another reason why I don't think they did is they approached, the PNAC group, the Project for New American mm-hmm. Country group, approached Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of Likud in Israel, back in the 90s while Clinton was president. And Netanyahu is one of the more hawkish leaders of Israel, far, far more hawkish than the current government, which I think is pretty much on the left. And they approached him in the 90s and they said, hey, would Israel love for us to go in Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein? And Netanyahu said, no, Iraq isn't a danger to Israel. Iran is a danger. Iraq is really not that big a danger. So, I think it would hurt Israel. And despite the fact that Wolfowitz and Feith and all the PNAC people heard it would hurt Israel, they went ahead and decided to go against Iraq. So I don't know whether they thought they knew more about helping Israel than Netanyahu did, but even the Likud leader told them no. And so, no, I think the Iraq war was a terrible, terrible mistake, but I think it's really hard to blame Israel for it.
Well, it's just that guys like Feith and Wolfowitz, you know, and AIPAC and all this mess, these people all together, certainly had a profound influence on the Bush administration. And that's what I resent. And the money that they're pouring into the United States Congress, AIPAC. You don't agree that
AIPAC doesn't give any money. You know that, right? AIPAC is not a PAC. It's not a political action committee. It's a public affairs committee. AIPAC itself doesn't raise a penny for any campaign. All their money is spent. I mean, they definitely raise money and use it to lobby. In other words, they use it to go into members of Congress's offices and convince them to do things that are pro-Israel. But they don't give money to campaigns. They're not
Why is it then that guys like, if no money changes hands with our congressman from at least originates somehow with AIPAC, why is it guys like Joe Biden are down there, when was it, Monday, kissing their ass?
Because Joe Biden supports Israel. As does Obama. As does McCain.
And you don't think they support Israel because they have to?
No, I really don't. I think they support Israel because they recognize of Israel's strategic influence. You know, there was a time when America didn't support Israel. Truman did when Israel was first formed, but Eisenhower was quite strongly anti-Israel, in fact. It really wasn't until the Six-Day War, in fact, till Israel got a little more power and wasn't, you know, barely surviving, that America saw it as a strategic ally. Before then, Israel had to get arms from France, from the communist nations. You know, a lot of people don't remember that early history.
But, well, the early history is not that great, is it? If you're thinking about the ethics and morals of Israel as a state, it's not all that. The early history with the bombing of the King David Hotel and the way they, you know, the promises of the Brits not to take over only a certain percentage. And you can possibly understand why some of the neighbors around there aren't all that happy.
No, I really can't. If the Arabs had accepted any of the plans that were offered them, you know, from the 1939 Peel Commission plan to the 1947 partition plan to the first 19 years of Israel's existence, there was a state that was supposed to be an Arab state, and Egypt and Jordan just took it over. I mean, they've had every opportunity to have a state, and they've always, always used it to attack Israel. You know, I'm reminded of what Shimon Peres said just a few weeks ago. Now, he's the most liberal leftist Israeli you've got. He's the opposite of Netanyahu. And he said he, of course, strongly advocated for withdrawal from Gaza, as did I, by the way. And he just came clean and said, you know what, I never imagined that the Palestinians would take Gaza and use it to shoot missiles into Israel. I thought they'd use it and start it being a foundation of a peaceful state, and I was wrong. He said, the more we're lenient to them, the more they've attacked us. And that was Peres saying that, the left of Israel saying that. And it...
You there? Hello, Mark? We've lost our connection with Mark. I think he'll probably give us a call right back. Call us right back, Mark. We'll get him right back here. Listen to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. I don't know when that's happened in a long, long time. We just completely lost Mark there on the line. Maybe he was on a cell phone and it went dead or something. Mark, give us a call back if you're there. He'll call back here in just a moment or two. Don't go anyway. Interesting conversation we're having with Mark so far, and I know when we get him back on the line here, he'll want to defend himself on it. He's 100% obviously behind just about anything Israel does, and that's a little bit of the problem I'm having here. Oh, yoo-hoo, Mark, give us a call back. Here we go. We'll get him back here now. I don't see why you had to hang up on us.
I did not hang up on you, I assure you. I don't know what happened.
I don't know.
I assure you.
Mark, I was just mentioning to everybody to fill a moment or two there. So far in our conversation, you seem to be not 99% in favor of everything Israel does, but about 100%. Would I be?
Well, it depends. There are things Israel does that I don't support. I don't think expansion of settlements is a good idea at all. While Abbas is trying to succeed. I think Olmert probably is corrupt and probably should be removed from office for that reason. That's not really a critique on Israel, but it is a critique on Olmert. I don't sanction spying on the United States. I'm just saying everybody does it. We do it, and other countries do it. But I don't think it's a good thing.
How about this wall? I'm looking at a
picture. Wall.
You support the wall?
Absolutely.
God, I don't think I've seen anything so offensive.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think the French had a right to build the Maginot Line to keep the Germans from invading?
To keep them?
I think they did.
I've got a thing about walls. It looks like a prison, Mark. It looks like a prison, and I can't imagine being on the wrong side of that wall.
You have a door in your house, Guy, right, with a lock on it?
I do.
Okay, why do you lock that door?
I lock that door to keep people out, but I think everybody that's got a house can do that. But on public property, it's a prison camp. It is. I agree with the ambassador on that. It is the world's largest open-air prison camp.
If you're the head of a country and you have hundreds of people streaming across that country and they've got bombs on their back and those bombs are full of nails and shards and they're going into public discotheques and wedding receptions, and they are on a regular basis blowing it up and killing hundreds of people day after day after day. Might you want to have checkpoints at borders and walls to keep people from going out?
You want to give me the numbers on which one of those has killed the most?
There's a difference between responding to attacks and being attacked.
There's a difference between responding 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1, too.
Well, you know, what can I say? There's a difference. There's a difference between going in there and trying to bomb a discotheque where people are trying to dance, and going in there and bombing a car full of people with a bomb in them. I mean, you know, it's not about numbers. It's about killing innocent civilians.
Well, it is about numbers in the long run. I mean, how many people have the Israelis killed when you start talking about civilians? And how many people have the surrounding the Palestinians and the Lebanese and Hezbollah and all that? How many have they killed? And I would submit to you that
percentages, obviously, the Arabs have killed a lot more. If you look at it in numbers, I'm sure Israel's killed more.
Yeah.
You know, they murdered 1% of all of Israel in its founding, which is an amazing number. It would be the equivalent to killing 3 million Americans.
That's where we got cut off when we were talking about the beginning of Israel little bit. Don't you think that some of those at the beginning of the State of Israel were a little bit of terrorists themselves?
No. Do you think George Washington was a terrorist when he crossed the Delaware and killed all those Hessians in New Jersey?
No.
On Christmas Day?
No, I don't.
Why not?
No, I don't.
Why was that?
Well, he was fighting for a new cause, but
right. King David was the head of the British military center. The British had agreed to international law. International law said there would be a Jewish state created. Britain went back on international law, refused to implement the United Nations partition resolution, even though they had given it to the United Nations to decide. They went back on their word. They said, we're not going to follow international law. And in the meantime, they helped an armed Transjordan, hoping it would conquer and massacre all the Jews. Britain was obviously trying to destroy the Jewish state.
And the promise of the ownership, the percentage of ownership in the State of Israel, was promised to never be over, what, 25%? And it turns out that the Jewish population ended up owning all of it.
Well, no, they don't never own the part that became Jordan. So that's the Western Palestine is 20%. Even if you give all of the West Bank and Gaza, which I don't support, but even if you give all of that land to Israel, they still only have 20% of mandatory Palestine.
So you don't understand why the Israel isn't a burr under the saddle to those people.
To who?
To the surrounding people, the people that threaten Israel.
I do. Look, and it depends on whether you're talking about a Palestinian Arab or you're talking about Arabs in general. For Muslims in general, I don't think they care that much about Israel, except that it's sort of a manner of losing face. It's like they want to control the entire Middle East, and 0.01% of it is not their territory, and that offends them, because Jews and Christians are traditionally dhimmi, they're second-class citizens, and for this inferior people to control Arabs is an insult to many Arabs around the world. Now, that's a different question.
And we have that same attitude here.
Yes, we do. Many Americans do. Absolutely. There's a lot of Christians that talk about a crusade in Iraq, and that's just as offensive. Absolutely.
Well, it's not something limited to one country. We've all got the same problem.
No question about it. You and I could go on a long time. It's to me that the problem is I see a real one-sidedness, particularly from that ambassador. I mean,
one-sided. Can you tell me about all of the bad things that the press has said about AIPAC and Israel? I mean, it's people are intimidated.
I think the press says more bad things about AIPAC than any lobby in America, and I wonder about that. You know, I don't hear that kind of impact against Latinos when they're arguing for better immigration laws, or when you have unions or I mean, there's some pushback. NRA, these are American citizens that are lobbying their government for what they believe is right. You can disagree with them.
But they're lobbying for a country that's rich and powerful. If we're going to talk about the Latinos fighting for the
rich or powerful, it's nowhere near as rich or powerful as America or England or Germany or France or Japan or any of the other nations we give so much aid to.
We give half of it to Israel.
No. See, that's what Ambassador Peck said. And let me tell you how he comes with that calculation. We do not have troops in Israel. We don't fund troops in Israel.
They don't need them. They don't want them.
Well, that's true, too. But it would be a lot more expensive to have troops there. We have troops in Japan. We have troops in Germany. And that's far more expensive. But it comes from our military budget. And Israel comes from our foreign aid budget. So when he says it's half of our foreign aid budget, he doesn't include the tremendous amount of money we spend on NATO and on Japan and on South Korea and on, you know, other countries that we help. So yeah, I guarantee you we spend more on South Korea than we do on Israel. And, you know, you can argue whether us having bases in South Korea is more important than having bases in Israel. I don't blame the South Koreans. I think they are in danger, and I think they also should have our support.
Well, I should know better than to ever argue with a lawyer.
There's so much here.
There is so much here. We're going to do this again, and we're going to do it when we have more time.
I just want to correct that I heard the ambassador say.
Okay.
He said that Omer talked about the absolute necessity of attacking Iran. And just for fun, I went on Google, and I typed in Omer and, quote, absolute necessity of attacking Iran, unquote, and there was no document. So I took out absolute, and I put in necessity of attacking Iran, and there were no documents. So then I just put Omer in attacking Iran, and you can do this yourself, folks, to get a Google search, and all the things that came up were Israel has no intention of attacking Iran, and Israel stopped short of saying they should attack Iran. And so, you know, I don't know where this...
He's here to persuade us to do it.
I think there's a difference between attacking and occupation.
He's gonna persuade us to do it. There isn't any doubt about it he wants us to do. He's probably foaming at the mouth over that to get us to attack Iran.
I think there's a huge difference between attacking and occupying. And the occupation of Iraq was a huge mistake, but I'll give you something that was a success, and that was Israel's bombing of Syria's nuclear plant and Israel's bombing of Iraqi nuclear plant. Note that Syria didn't even respond, and they didn't respond because they knew Israel was right, and they just rushed to hide the evidence. There are all kinds of uses of force. I think it would be suicide for Israel, the United States, or anybody to invade Iran. That would be the stupidest, most ridiculous policy ever. But to consider having a threat of one strike on a nuclear plant if it comes in power, that's a different thing.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Israel and the United States and France and South Africa and all the people, Pakistan and India, everybody can have nuclear weapons, but we're going to make sure nobody else gets them.
I don't mind if a democracy has it. I really don't.
Yeah.
It's dictatorships that scare me.
Because the democracy is the best, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Because we're democratized, so hey, Mark.
Neither is Israel, for sure. There's a difference between us and Iran.
Absolutely, Mark. Pleasure having you on, buddy. And
you guys.
We'll talk to you again soon, and we'll do this again very soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks
for having me on.
Bye now. Oh, the irrepressible Mark Levine. I promised you early on today that we were going to, since we're not on tomorrow on the show, that we wanted to pay our respects to Robert F. Kennedy today. And of all my of all the Kennedy people, I must say that Bobby was my favorite, and I just wanted to have a salute and a memorial, little memorial here today for Robert F. Kennedy, a man that I think would have changed the face of America had he been able to take over the presidency, and I'm pretty sure he would have gotten it. Loving, compassionate man, and a man that I had huge respect for. And so we're going to pay our respects to Robert F. Kennedy.
Do they know about Martin Luther King?
We have left it up to your own list that can be handled.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are. And what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand and compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed. But he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. And he once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another. Feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Senator, how are you going to counter Mr. Humphreys and his backgrounding you as far as the delegate votes go?
I think it's old tactic trouble for us.
Somebody said, Robert.
What? Senator Kennedy has been shot in the head. I am right here. Draper Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. He has fired the shot. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun. Get the gun. Get the gun. Stay away from the gun. Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. Okay, now hold on to the guy. Hold on to him. Hold on to him, ladies and gentlemen. They have the gun away from the man. In this shot. They've got the gun. I can't see. I can't see the man. I can't see who it is.
Your Eminences, Your Excellencies, Mr. President, on behalf of Mrs. Kennedy, her children, parents and sisters of Robert Kennedy, I want to express what we feel to those who mourn with us today in this cathedral and around the world. We loved him as a brother, and as a father, and as a son. From his parents and from his older brothers and sisters, Joe and Kathleen, Jack, he received an inspiration which he passed on to all of us. He gave us strength in time of trouble, wisdom in time of uncertainty, and sharing in time of happiness. He will always be by our side. Love is not an easy feeling to put into words, nor is loyalty, or trust, or joy. But he was all of these. He loved life completely, and he lived it intensely. A few years back, Robert Kennedy wrote some words about his own father, which expresses the way we and his family felt about him. He said of what his father meant to him, quote, "What it really all adds up to is love. Not love as it is described with such facility in popular magazines, but the kind of love that is affection and respect, order and encouragement and support. Our awareness of this was an incalculable source of strength. And because real love is something unselfish and involves sacrifice and giving, we could not help but profit from it." And he continued, "Beneath it all, he has tried to engender a social conscience. There were wrongs which needed attention. There were people who were poor and needed help. We have a responsibility to them and to this country. Through no virtues and accomplishments of our own, we have been fortunate enough to be born in the United States under the most comfortable conditions. We, therefore, have a responsibility to others who are less well off." That is what Robert Kennedy was given. What he leaves to us is what he said, what he did, and what he stood for. A speech he made to the young people of South Africa on their day of affirmation in 1966 sums it up the best, and I would like to read it now. "There is discrimination in this world, and slavery and slaughter and starvation. Governments repress their people. Millions are trapped in poverty while the nation grows rich and wealth is lavished on armaments everywhere. These are differing evils, but they are the common works of man. They reflect the imperfection of human justice, the inadequacy of human compassion, our lack of sensibility towards the suffering of our fellows. But we can perhaps remember, even if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as we do, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment they can. Surely this bond of common faith, this bond of common goal, can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn, at least to look at those around us as fellow men. And surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our own hearts brothers and countrymen once again. The answer is to rely on you. Not a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over the love of ease. The cruelty and obstacles of this swiftly changing planet will not yield to the obsolete dogmas and outworn slogans. They cannot be moved by those who cling to a present that is already dying, who prefer the illusion of security to the excitement and danger that come with even the most peaceful progress. It is a revolutionary world we live in, and this generation at home and around the world has had thrust upon it a greater burden of responsibility than any generation that has ever lived. Some believe there is nothing one man or one woman can do against the enormous array of the world's ills. Yet many of the world's great movements of thought and action have flowed from the work of a single man. A young monk began the Protestant Reformation. A young general extended an empire from Macedonia to the borders of the earth. A young woman reclaimed the territory of France. And it was a young Italian explorer who discovered the New World, and the 32-year-old Thomas Jefferson who reclaimed that all men are created equal. These men moved the world, and so can we all. Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events. And in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Few are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. And I believe that in this generation, those with the courage to enter the moral conflict will find themselves with companions in every corner of the globe. For the fortunate among us, there is the temptation to follow the easy and familiar paths of personal ambition and financial success, so grandly spread before those who enjoy the privilege of education. But that is not the road history has marked out for us. Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty. But they are also more open to the creative energy of men than any other time in history. All of us will ultimately be judged. And as the years pass, we will surely judge ourselves on the effort we have contributed to building a new world society and the extent to which our ideals and goals have shaped that event. Our future may lie beyond our vision, but it is not completely beyond our control. It is the shaping impulse of America that neither fate nor nature nor the irresistible tides of history, but the work of our own hands, matched to reason and principle, that will determine our destiny. There is pride in that, even arrogance, but there is also experience and truth. In any event, it is the only way we can live. That is the way he lived. That is what he leaves us. My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today, pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times, in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
You know, we can talk about men like Robert Kennedy and Abraham, Martin, and John, and we'll talk from now and forevermore about what we've lost about having them cut down in the prime of life and how things may have been different. We can look at it that way, and I do, from time to time, think about how things may have been different if Martin Luther King had lived, and John Kennedy had lived, and Robert Kennedy had lived on. I wonder about those things. But on the other hand, I stop and think of what wonderful things did happen because they had all been on this earth. I thank God that Martin Luther King was here and did what he did. And hate to think where we'd be today without him and men like him and others that joined in his fight. I thank God that John Kennedy was here when he was to reinvigorate this nation, to get this nation going again. bring us out of the doldrums and get us believing ourselves and get us getting us back to loving America and having getting respect from around the world. And I thank God for Robert F. Kennedy being here. He was a great visionary, a man of love and peace and compassion, a man that would have made a great president, but nonetheless, his presence has been felt on this earth since the day he was gone. If you go to Washington and you stand in Arlington Cemetery and you go up to President John F. Kennedy's grave, very close by, you will see Robert Kennedy's grave. Simple, unimposing. Like John Kennedy's grave, it looks out over the mall, looks down the mall of Washington, D.C., toward the Lincoln Monument and the Washington Monument and the Capitol Building. And it's fitting that those two graves are where they are, and very deserving for both of them. It's always sad when these anniversaries come around. We think where we were when it happened, and I can remember very well where I was when Robert Kennedy was killed and where I was when Martin Luther King was killed. And you heard earlier in that audio Robert Kennedy breaking the news to a crowd that he was about to speak to. Little did he know at that time that he would join Martin Luther King not so far down the road. But once again, it is easy to look back and see the tragedy of the situation, but I do ask everybody on these days like this to remember how good it was that Abraham, Martin, Bobby, and John walked the face of this earth. They all left a legacy that's been beneficial for all of us, and it's a good time to remember that. I've enjoyed this program today. I enjoyed very much talking to Mark. Mark Levine, great guy, good broadcaster. Knows everything there is to know about Washington, I think. And we enjoyed having him on, and also enjoyed having Ed on. A very knowledgeable man about the Middle East. He's lived there and been there quite a lot, and it's always a pleasure to have an expert on that really knows what he's talking about. And he does. And you may agree or disagree with some statements that he made, but look it up. Google it and decide for yourself. You can find very many writings that it has on the Internet. That, my oh my, is bringing us down to the end of the program today. I'm feeling a little melancholy this afternoon after all that about Bobby Kennedy, and I've been thinking about that a lot today. I didn't get a chance to talk about John, and we're going to call him, thanks to our friend Stuart. It's a good idea. John, you got to be kidding me, McCain, from now on. I've got very much to say about John McCain, and I know you do as well, and we'll discuss it in the future from time to time. Just about every day we'll talk about something about Mr. John, you got to be kidding me, Sidney McCain. I've got volumes of stuff ready here to discuss about him, things that you haven't heard in the media yet and things that everybody needs to know as we go into this election season. So thanks so much for joining me here today on the Guy James Show. Please do remember our plea all every day this week that we are a listener-supported program, and it's very, very critical that we get your help at this time. And www.theguyjamesshow.com if you'd like to help us out, and thanks so much to those